As long as the abuse or neglect experienced in childhood remains buried within, we recreate our family and adult relationships. My name is Andrea, and this is Adult Child. Welcome back to Adult Child, where we take a deep dive into the impact of growing up in a dysfunctional family. Ahoy, my dear shitshows. For any new listeners, my name is Andrea and I am a total shitshow, in case you were wondering. I am also an adult child of an alcoholic family. I'm also a recovering alcoholic myself. And folks, I don't know what I touched, but my finger smells like ketchup right now. And it made me think that I really should share my attachment style condiment correlation theory, because I don't think I've shared it recently on the podcast. Now, this is a study that I've been conducting for a few years now, folks. And I really think there's something here. I really think that there's something here. So here's my theory. People who have an anxious attachment style, they love their fucking condiments. They love their ketchup. They love their mustard. They love all of their sauces. And then people who are avoidance, maybe a little some, a little condiment here and there, but mostly they just like their shit plain. And this theory is proven to be tried and true, folks. I would say it has about a 92% accuracy rate. I'm not sure what we do with it, because it, like, maybe there's some sort of a healing method there. Like, do we force anxious people to not be able to use condiments? I say hell no to that, but I do think that we should start forcing avoidant people to use heavy sauce, heavy on the sauce. So welcome aboard. I'm an acquired taste. I like to curse. I just had somebody comment on one of my TikTok videos. I wish I could listen to your content, but the language is too much. And I said, I'm not everyone's cup of tea, but I'm my cup of tea. So you've been warned, I curse here. So today we are joined by Dr. Kenneth Adams. He's a therapist. He is the author of many a book. I know him through his book, Silently Seduced, When a Parent Marries Their Child. So he's big on emotional enmeshment, covert incest. He also is the author of When He's Married to Mom, How to Help Mother Enmeshed Men Open Up Their Hearts to True Love and Commitment. That's not been my cup of tea. Maybe that's better than emotionally unavailable alcoholics. I don't know. You tell me. But so his most recent book, and this came out, I think it was in February of 2023, and he wrote this with two other therapists. It is titled A Light in the Dark, The Hidden Legacy of Adult Children of Sex Addicts. So that is what we are talking about today, adult children of sex addicts. And this was a really interesting conversation for me. And as you'll hear Kenneth say, this is a group of adult children that he thinks is not getting the attention that they deserve, that this is a subset of adult children that is a lot more common than perhaps we would think. But I want to go through the list of the characteristics that he has. I'm just curious too of how applicable they are for other types of ACAs, because I do think that a lot of these are probably applicable to people who have endured sexual abuse themselves. I think that some of these things are characteristics that adult children have regardless of whether they've endured any sort of sexual abuse or not. So ACSAs carry shame about their sexuality and are often confused about appropriate sexual behavior for others and themselves. ACSAs are often uncomfortable with their bodies and gender and may go to extremes to compensate. They might purposely make themselves unattractive to others or overvalue being attractive. ACSAs can either be uncomfortable with physical touch or feel an insatiable need for it. ACSAs can be extreme in their sexual attitudes. either too permissive or too judgmental. ACSAs can become sexually compulsive or sexually avoidant, either sexualizing experiences not meant to be sexual or retreating and escaping when it is actually safe and healthy to be sexual. ACSAs often view someone's sexual interest as a sign of love or as a violation, although neither one may be accurate. ACSAs can be drawn to and overvalue the intensity, risk, drama, and sexual excitement in an intimate relationship. ACSAs unknowingly lack healthy value systems and sexual boundaries. ACSAs are either hypervigilant or unaware of the role of safety, trust, and play in relationships. ACSAs may overcommit or try to fix those who have hurt them emotionally and/or sexually. Two more. ACSAs may have difficulty sharing their vulnerability and trusting in intimate relationships. I think that that is one that is applicable to most of us adult children. And then ACSAs often continue to declare loyalties to their families of origin by allowing themselves to be used by their parents for comfort, to combat loneliness, or to stabilize them emotionally at a high cost to themselves, their intimate partnerships, relationships with children, and family of choice. I would think that also is one that is applicable to many of us. So yeah, let's get the damn show on the road. Oh, and also he is an ACA himself. He is an ACSA himself. This guy's a pioneer. I said, you're kind of a pioneer. He opened up a damn practice in 1985 for adult children of alcoholics. And that's really when all this shit was starting to boom. So again, grateful for people like him and Tian and Claudia Black and all of those folks who really paved the road for us to be able to have a chance to heal and recover. So let's get the damn show on the road. But first, let's talk about why you, yes, you need to damn the Join Shit Show. I don't know if you heard this past week's Shit Show Saturday episode, but I spoke with three fellow shit shows about healing from having a narcissistic parent and the ways in which that's shown up in their lives. This is another, like, a subset that we have within the community. This is another thing that makes this shit show community so attractive, is that it's not just a way for you to connect with, you know, just other adult children of dysfunctional families, but we have all these subgroups in there for, like, specific topics if you're looking for people to connect with those issues. So, you know, child sexual abuse. If you're a parent and you need support there. If you are neurodivergent, healing from narcissists. What else do we have? Like, dudes, the shit show dude community is blowing the fuck up. So I also have 4 weekly Zoom support groups. And this is the place to be for $1 a day. Less than $1 a day, folks. So how about you damn the Join Shit Show? Please see the link in the bio. We're waiting for you. Yes, you. Oh, and actually, this weekend, we are having a shit show meetup in Chicago. So this is like our 3rd official. And it's just so fun to spend time in person. And what I'm most excited about is to stuff my face with food and to laugh. We'll definitely play games. I'm like a Boulder Dash freak for anybody who knows Boulder Dash. So it's just like nonstop laughter and just feeling so comfortable. So if you're looking for friends, we're here in this damn shit show community waiting for you. I just sent out my newsletter for the week. So I'm talking about the sense of a foreshortened future, something that I struggle with some, and I think it's very common for us adult children to struggle with. So I am kind of confronting this from a reparenting perspective. And so you can find a link to my newsletter in the show notes as well. Give me a little follow on the Insta and the TikTok at Adult Child Pod. And last but not least, whatever you do, give me a damn 5-star rating on Apple, on Spotify. Thank you. Love you all. All right, y'all. Well, you're in for a damn treat. We have Dr. Kenneth Adams. You are an adult child of alcoholics pioneer.
Well, not really.
I think so. If you opened up your practice in 85 to help us ACAs,
I did.
That was two years after Janet's book came out. I would say that's true. A pioneer, okay?
I was in the mix.
Yeah, tell me about that. I mean, I've had Tion Dayton on a couple of times. I don't know if you're familiar with her.
Yeah, she's great. Yeah,
she's
right there. I was trained to work with kids. And so I was working in a psychiatric facility for children and adolescents in Detroit. And about the same time, I began a personal recovery as an adult child of an alcoholic parent. And I was working in this facility, and I had an absolute great opportunity to work with the male adolescent ward, which nobody wanted to do because these guys were not interested, right? Gangbangers. And so I would drag them down at 9 o'clock in the morning, and I would do my cognitive behavioral techniques, and they looked at me like I was from Mars. Well, one day I walked in there, and I had gone to a few meetings. I'd read Patrick Carnes' book on sex addiction, The Family System. And I thought, well, what the heck? I'm just going to tell my story. So I told my story, and I was shocked. Half the kids were crying, telling their story. So every morning at 5 to 9, they'd be lined up waiting for me to go to group. So that began my sort of awareness that recovery models for treatment really do work. So I shifted from kids to adult kids. So being trained to work with kids helped me work with adults who were developmentally delayed because of their adult children status. And so I fit right into that group, you know. And so from there, I just kind of kept going. So that's the short story.
So I want to hear about, like, what was your coming to terms with? Well, the question I usually like to start with is, like, when did you realize that your childhood screwed you up a lot more than you initially thought?
When the woman I was dating no longer wanted to date me and suggested I see a therapist instead.
Mm-hmm.
I said, oh, okay. That's not my idea of what I was thinking about, but all right. So I did. So it wasn't some great insight. It was somebody who saw something I didn't see in me. And so the first question the therapist asked me, well, I told her my story a little bit.
When was this? Like early 80s?
I guess it had been mid-80s. I'm dating myself. I wrote my first book in 91. So that was about 5 years after I got started. And so, yeah. So the therapist, about 10 minutes into the session, says, was your father an alcoholic? I thought, how did you know?
Mm-hmm.
So it wasn't some great bolt of insight. It was somebody who said, no, I think you're better off seeing a therapist than me. And I said, okay. So I took the card and I took her advice. We remained friends, and that was it.
So is that when you first heard the term?
Yeah.
Uh-huh. And were there many meetings around at that point in time?
There were. Well, that was the beginning of the cusp. That was Sharon Berkshire Cruz. Claudia Black had published her book. I mean, the adult child movement was screaming. But what I noticed in my own personal recovery, as well as my work professionally, is that those parents who were also sex addicts, that wasn't being talked about. There was a sort of no talk rule, even though the movement was breaking the barrier of no talking. Nobody was talking about the fact that about a third of those alcoholic parents were also acting out sex. And that you couldn't really capture the impact of that underneath a typical ACOA meeting because you can't talk about it. And it's the same shame that, oh my, if anybody knew what my father or mother was doing behind closed doors or right in front of me, you know, it's a layer of shame that doesn't get addressed in the ACOA literature or the meetings. You might get a mention here and there, just not happening. And so that was what led me many years later to write the book. My last book I co-wrote with some colleague and Dr. Mary Meyer and Kelly Vandegaard, A Light in the Dark. So this was a book specifically for adult children of sex addicts. We took it out from the umbrella of ACOA. We took it out from the umbrella of addiction and partner trauma and codependency. We specifically looked in that book through the lens of being an adult child of a sex addicted parent and that family system. There's different characteristics, different roles, different outcomes, different stuff that has to happen. Although telling your story is essential to it, to get out from the shame. But there's a layer of shame that is not addressed in the adult children of alcoholics movement.
It's so fascinating.
So yeah. That's why it was in the back of my mind ever since I started my personal and professional work. I thought this book needs to be written. And I thought it was the first book, and then somebody reminded me there was a book many years ago on adult children sex eddies. So I've decided that we have the first best book out there on adult children sex eddies.
Yeah, I mean, it's not something that I really hear discussed much at all, even today.
A third of the people sitting in those meetings have sex addictive parents. And some of the struggle, particularly around intimacy, body image, sexuality, shamefulness, embarrassment. Well, I can't figure out, you know, whether somebody is interested in me because they're stalking me or because it's an innocent act of it's very different. Lots of difficulty understanding the courtship dance and making bad choices and missing opportunities or attaching to opportunities I should be running from. So that's specific to
growth. Well, I mean, I can fucking relate to that. That's all I did was attach to opportunities I shouldn't have.
That's specific. I mean, you can get there in a number of ways.
Yeah.
But what adult children of sex addicts have in common is that issue, is their compass around sexuality, intimacy, romance, trouble.
So, okay. So like we got the laundry list traits. Now, do all of those you think apply to an adult child of a sex addict?
What are you talking about?
The laundry list traits, the ACA laundry, like the 14 characteristics of an adult child.
Not all of them. You'll have to remind me, you know, it's been a while since I've seen the list, but.
Well, you just did, but maybe you could do it again. Like what would be something that is, because I don't know. I feel like the whole intimacy thing. I mean, I feel like that's big for all adult children. I guess, what would you say are some very, very specific traits to adult children of sex? And the other thing I'd be curious about as well is, how does that differ from adult children of like love addicts?
Well, so let me set a good question. So one of the first things that adults, so we did some qualitative and quantitative research, meaning we put together a survey. We've got a number of adult children who responded to the survey, quantitative, not big numbers, but still interesting. And then we did some interviewing, which was really interesting. So we kind of dug down. So the one characteristic I can tell you that isn't showing up in the ACA literature is I feel sexual shame because of my parents' sexual behavior. Nothing in the ACAOA literature saying that. So that's a very specific issue. I have sexual shame or body shame because of my father or mother's inappropriate sexual behavior, because of their sexual remarks about gender, about me, about my friends, their crassness. Or I have sexual shame because of my family's rigidity and reaction to sexual acting out in the previous generation, or the partner. So we
that was going to be my question. A question I had.
Children of sex addicts are impacted by the parent with the sexual addiction behavior. Again, about a number of those will be alcoholics as well. That gets brushed under the carpet of the ACA. Now, don't get me wrong. That's where my personal recovery started. But it's not dealing with this. There's nobody going to the ACA meeting saying, I have sexual shame and I don't feel good about my sexuality because of my father's affairs. That's not happening. So that's a very specific characteristic. They also feel burdened, and this is a crossover, but they feel burdened by the spouse's pain and suffering, particularly if the spouse who uses them as a surrogate husband.
The parent, you mean?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. The spouse of the sex addict parent.
Okay, got it. Yeah, okay.
Yeah. So that's common in the ACA. What's different is that spouse sometimes will make shaming messages so you don't turn out like your father.
Mm-hmm.
So don't you dare, you know, so we get a more specific sexual shaming message from the partner. So when you interview the adult children of sex addicts, they feel sexually shamed by both parents.
Mm-hmm.
And they feel burdened by the parents' conflict and the secrecy in the family system. They feel burdened by the spouse's betrayal and suffering.
Mm-hmm.
They feel responsible, particularly if they kept secrets for the acting out parent.
Mm.
So if I kept secrets from my father in his affairs, I feel like I betrayed my mother. So again, that's specific to the sexually addicted system.
It's like putting in that enmeshment there.
Exactly. So those are some, so what you begin to see is a more descriptive sexual shaming construct in that group that's not talked about. So the and what happens in the ACA literature, or for that matter, other literature too, is it's put under the umbrella of intimacy, love, addiction, mm-hmm, so mm-hmm. forth. So codependency will is this broad umbrella. But mm-hmm. what we did with the adult child stuff is we burrowed in and said, no, this group has something specific to say that your broader umbrella is not capturing. So anyway, so yes, you're correct. There's a crossover, but very specific sexual shaming, burdened by both the acting out behavior, the spouse's use of the child for a surrogate comfort, a partner. Mm-hmm. They're burdened by the sexual secrecy. They're burdened by the shaming and the sort of, we don't talk about that. You have an innocent girlfriend or boyfriend, and next thing you know, your mother's reacting to you like you've committed a mortal sin. Mm-hmm. And coming from the sexually addicted system, don't you dare become like your father or mother.
Could simply a parent, let's say the parent's not a sex addict, but the parent discloses, talks about their sex life with their kid, mm-hmm. would that result in the same behavior? Because I mean, that's like covert incest there, but would, like, let's say that the parent doesn't have a sex addiction, but they're sharing sexual details with their child. Would you consider that under the same umbrella?
Well, so that would be a kind of a subset, right? Okay. So right, my first couple books were on enmeshment and covert silence use when he's married to mom. Mm-hmm. So we talked in there about the parent who turns to the child as a surrogate lover, so to speak, partner, replacement. And so they wind up oftentimes inappropriately sharing. That child will indeed become confused, burdened, conflicted, and it'll whittle down into their own erotic love template. They'll get confused. What's normal? What's right? Are you using me? Is this good? Is this bad? You know, so there'll be a similar impact in the sexually addicted system. It's just broader. There's more of it. There's more avenue. So you have both the inappropriate use of the child and the sharing of the child, the parent saying things out loud during a fight, you know, to the father or to the mother that the kid picks up on. Mm-hmm. So the short answer is yes. The longer answer is in the sexually addicted system, there's just more of it.
More of it, yeah. Well, the other thing that's so interesting too is, you know, I try to bring the message out about, you know, GCOAs, grandchildren of alcoholics, and think about how many GCOSs there are out there, like grandchildren of sex addicts. There's probably so many people out there who have no fucking clue that that's what the deal is, because that's even less talked about. Like, I'm sure that's less of a chance that they would find out that their grandparent was a sex addict.
Right. Well, then now you're talking about the intergenerational transmission of
sex addiction. Yeah. What are you seeing there compared to like other forms of, you know, intergenerational trauma, like when it is that the sexual shame aspect of it?
Well, so the commonality with intergenerational trauma is you don't need to be exposed directly to the trauma to be impacted. Mm-hmm. The kids who are most studied are the Holocaust, the Holocaust survivors. They show fears of death and issues of scarcity, and they feel bad for wanting something indulgent because their parents said, we suffered and you have to learn to live without. So we see this. So that group has been studied quite a bit. And
genetic markings.
You can see the transmission of trauma. In sexually addicted systems, you could have a grandparent. So grandma was having, you know, her fun with everybody in the neighborhood, right? And so we usually pick on the men for sex addiction, but the truth is women can do this too. And then there's a divorce, and then there's shame in a generation where you didn't get divorced. And though that family system has kids, and now those kids get exposed to grandma running around and getting talked about, getting their mother talked about. So they adopt attitudes about sexuality. Mm-hmm. They get rigid. They get shaming, or they might get permissive or act. Mm-hmm. And so they have children, and their children innocently say, well, geez, you know, how did the eggs get fertilized, during science class or something? Or, I have a crush on somebody, or you can tell you have a crush. And all of a sudden that adult child of grandma comes barreling down on top of that kid. Mm-hmm. Don't you dare talk about that. I don't want you to be a whore. This is a young girl having her first crush, and now she associates her innocence with the word whore. And that comes from two generations, or a generation previously, that parent was reacting to grandma. So that kid now becomes conflicted. They wind up marrying a sex addict or becoming one herself. So now you repeat the trauma. And so you get that through the messaging, through the attitudes, through the extremes around sexuality, either rigidity or permissiveness. No compass point. Nobody be an adult in the room. Sexuality is bad. We don't talk about that. Or we talk about it all the time. And that includes talking about the way your body looks in your pants, right? So there's this inappropriate commentary or this restrictive environment. Both of those will drive that kid to the same outcome.
Are you seeing a big mix of, you know, like hyper-religiosity that's playing in there as well?
You can. That can be one of the reactions to growing up in a sexually shaming system, is to get overly pious and moralistic by treating the inappropriate behavior as a moral crisis only, rather than an outcome of a family system or an addiction issue. And so if I only pray more, if I preach more, if I shame more, if I control more, my kid won't turn out like my father. But the trouble is, if you do that, your kid's likely to turn out like your father. Mm-hmm. If you over-control your child's emerging sense of self, they will find a way to sneak out the back door. And if you're shaming sexuality, they're going to do it in secret. They're going to do it in ways that are forbidden. So you've laid the groundwork for the very thing you're trying to control.
Mm-hmm. It's so interesting too. Like, so my story, I grew up in an alcoholic home, only child. Mom mm-hmm. was the alcoholic, found out when I was 7, very emotionally parentified by my dad. It was a secret from the rest of the world. He was only emotionally available to me when my mom was drunk and emotionally unavailable to him. Separation anxiety at 9, sent to the therapist. Years later, asked mom and dad, did you tell them that you were an alcoholic and that you guys fought all the time? Her response, no, it didn't seem relevant. So I became the identified patient.
It's not funny.
No, it's hilarious.
Not funny at all. Apologize.
No, it is, but we got to laugh at this shit. Yeah. So identified patient by 9, started drinking and using drugs at 12. 7th grade, became the school slut and became the girl that no one was allowed to be friends with, had to leave the private school. 8th grade in rehab for the first time, got sent to the Karen Foundation, and then spent the next year, it was like in and out of rehabs and boarding schools before getting sober at 19. And when I started to act out, well, that worked in fixing the family temporarily, right? My mom stopped drinking as much and my parents stopped fighting as much because they had to come together to deal with me. So it fucking worked.
Wow.
But then once I got sober, it's been a downward spiral and they're both in very late stages of alcoholism. It's tragic. And then I hit my adult child bottom at 9 years after years and years and years of relationships, not realizing that what I was experiencing was complex PTSD. No fucking clue. And I dated 2 alcoholics named Brian back to back.
You stayed with the bees.
Yeah. Yeah. And my first aha was at 7 years sober when I dated somebody for less than a month and he ghosted me. And I felt like I like literally was going to die. Like I became non-functioning. And the first aha was there's no way that this could actually be about this person. And the second aha was this is the same exact feeling that I felt when I woke up in the middle of the night and felt like I was going to die if I couldn't sleep in my mom's bed. And, you know, I had been in AA for, you know, 9 years the whole time. Nobody had really ever suggested like, hey, and I'd been in therapists too. Like nobody was like, hey, this is complex trauma. And that is the experience of so many. I think it's gotten a lot better in the past few years. That happened in 2018 is when I hit that bottom. But yeah, I mean, I just had no idea that, I mean, I knew that my childhood was less than ideal, but mm-hmm. I just thought that because I was never physically or sexually abused, because I became the primary problem, you know, at 9, I was just clueless about this. And this is just such an interesting conversation because, you know, my big message is like trying, I know that there's so many people out there who don't realize that they're an adult child of dysfunctional family. I'm wondering, like, how are you reaching all these people who don't realize that they're an adult child of a sex addict? I mean, that's got to be even harder to reach those people. Okay, shit show dudes, you can tune out. This is for my fellow shit show ladies. Are you going through perimenopause or menopause? I'm not quite there yet, but I know that I have plenty to look forward to. Feeling like a wet sock driving down the highway. Night sweats. Poor sleep. Feeling tired all the time. Bloating. Gas. Man, can't wait for this shit. Now, if that is applicable to you, then you have to try Hormone Harmony. So Hormone Harmony is not just a supplement for women going through perimenopause, menopause, or postmenopause. It's become a phenomenon. Women cannot stop talking about it. A bottle of Hormone Harmony is sold every 24 fucking seconds, okay? Now, Happy Mammoth, the company that created Hormone Harmony, is dedicated to making women's lives easier using only science-backed ingredients that have been proven to work. Now, for my younger shit show women like myself, if you struggle from that vicious week before your period, you want to crawl out of your skin, experience cravings, want to eat everything in the damn house, you feel a little bit down or off, well, Happy Mammoth also has a product for you to make it easier to manage your PMS with their Estro Control. So for a limited time, you can get 15% off your entire first order at happymammoth.com. Just use the code adultchild at checkout. That's happymammoth.com and use the code adultchild for 15% off today.
It is. Well, your story is common, you know, and it's courageous and important that you're out here speaking about it, you know, but for you. You know, it's interesting. One of the, if you look at the research on trauma, mm-hmm. one of the things that pops up is that trauma survivors can be poor reporters of their history because they've normalized it and it's familiar to them.
It's all they know.
It's all they know. And so I can't tell you the number of times I've asked clients, well, how was your child? You know, I've learned since. Was there any abuse growing up? No. And of course, these guys come in with multiple addictions, and you just know they got multiple abuse going
exactly.
on.
Exactly. No shit.
And so I say, well, tell me how you knew you were loved. And then they get silent. There is no evidence of it. Well, you have any examples? No. So then the egg gets cracked. So I've learned to ask different questions with clients. You know, tell me about the ways that you knew you were loved and were precious. And so much in these developmental trauma disorders, there's so much disruption in attachment, which is what you're describing with this anxiety, you know. And we see this even in enmeshment, you know, that as the kid moves away, both as a kid, young kid, young girl, young boy, and as an adult, they're anxious about separateness.
Yep.
About putting their 2 feet in the world and figuring it out. And so, you know, if you look at the research on development, the famous developmental psychologist, Eric Erickson, he said, young adults, adolescents, young adults who make the most of their opportunities are ones who have a secure base. Here, I'm loved and I get treated as precious, and I am free to separate. You need both.
So about like 10% of the population?
That's a good question.
Screw those people.
You know, we've been working hard in some of my work on enmeshment, because enmeshment, concept of too much entanglement with a parent, too much closeness. And my colleagues, all well-meaning, only talk about neglect, abuse, and abandonment. And they don't treat enmeshment as a developmental disorder when you're used by a parent to prop them up. And then you can't leave because you've absorbed their pain and loneliness. And now you're carrying what's not yours. You know, so, and these adults who have been enmeshed, you kind of described, you know, being used by your parents. What we see is we see school phobic kids in 35-year-old bodies. They get anxious upon separation because there's no secure base, and they've absorbed their mother or father's anxiety. And so it's good that you're focusing people on that. They have to go in and identify those adult child developmental issues, because they stay housed in your sense of self and in your brain and your memory systems as what we call state-dependent memories. You experience them as the original state, right? You feel like a 9-year-old girl.
Emotional flashbacks. The most painful thing in the whole wide world.
Yep. Yet you become, you know, decompensated almost if you're in one of those moments. So you're right to help people focus on that journey. because they need to get their story straight. And they need to understand that they have a part of them that needs to be attended to that may not be attended to by their addiction work.
Oh, absolutely not at all. I mean, I just view it all so differently now. I knew that alcohol was just a symptom, but now I view my alcoholism as just a symptom.
Yes.
I'm curious, when it comes to sex addiction and, you know, that being an attachment-based injury, like, do you view that any differently than, what an attachment injury would look like compared to other forms of family dysfunction? Part of the compulsivity that comes with sex addiction, I'm just wondering, how you feel about that.
Yeah, that's a good question. So, I think you're right. I think most people view, when they're willing to acknowledge that sex can become addicted, so we have a controversy in the field. But I think the research is quieting even the naysayers.
It can't be?
Yeah. Oh. So, yeah, I know they're willing to admit that you can get addicted to gambling and to the internet, but not sex. I'm thinking, how does sex get somehow excluded from the brain phenomena? So anyways, we'll leave that for people.
Well, love addiction, I can see that being a little bit more like controversial, but sex addiction seems pretty fucking obvious to me. So
there are some cases and some symptom profiles. What else would you say about this person? Mm-hmm. So in answer to your question, I think in most cases, the classic sex addict, that's the person who's been at it for 3 decades or 2 decades, probably has developmental trauma disorder issues and attachment failure. And the sex addiction becomes my way of compensating, right? So if I treat sex transactionally, if I treat people transactionally, if I compartmentalize, if I stay in control, if I ritualize it, then I can secure myself temporarily. But eventually the brain gets satiated, mm-hmm. right? And I need a little more pizzazz. I need a little more risk. I need a little more forbiddenness. Mm-hmm. So then you begin to move from a reaction to developmental trauma to its own path of addiction. So, mm-hmm. So on the front end, you want to use addiction treatment strategies as you begin to whittle down into the story. You need to do both. So that's the way I see that. Now, there are a group of people who are emerging, younger people, who don't have a trauma history. And who, because of the internet, because of the porn, because of the aggressiveness, because of the violence, because because you can capture your highest arousal moment, and you can build a what we call accelerators. You can build frame upon frame upon frame of that moment. And so you could get a 25-year-old kid coming out of college, or maybe 22-year-old coming out of college, stressed, curious, maybe hasn't had much of a sex life, pops on the internet. Wow. Curiosity, high stress, no trauma history. 6 months, they look like a full-blown addict.
Wow.
And that's the impact of, that's a whole nother story, but that's the impact of the internet.
Well, you know what that's like. I mean, that is essentially like fentanyl or Oxycontin, right? Like somebody who maybe didn't have a genetic predisposition for addiction.
Trauma history or trauma.
Gets put on painkillers and becomes an addict. It's very similar, huh?
Well, it used to be, they used to be coined the crack cocaine of sex addiction.
Mm.
What we now call contemporary sex addicts. Contemporary, people who are more inclined to use an app on a phone. Right, you can now that you have your personal computer in your hand, you can get access to everything and anything you want sexually.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And nothing's off limits. And the porn industry is very sophisticated at developing technologies to hook you.
Mm-hmm.
Very sophisticated. So we get people transgressing into underage porn who we would never see do that. When I mean underage, I mean going below 18, moving into teenage years, and that it's a sort of black hole. They're not at high risk to act out with anybody that way, but they could. But it's the internet and it's the exposure and the addictive quality that helps them sort of regress
Are there any unique differences with, let's say, son and dad's a sex addict, or son and mom is, or daughter and mom's sex addict, or daughter's dad's sex addict? Like, are there some pretty unique characteristics that form based off those dynamics?
Well, you know, you probably would have to add in a little more investigation about the whole system. So if dad is a sex addict and the son was mom's surrogate husband and caretaker, so he would be responsible for her pain. He knew her pain and her suffering, and didn't want that to happen to her, but he also saw the power of his father's addiction. And he identified with it. He said, I don't want to be a victim like my mother. I want to be powerful like a student. So I go off and I'm conflicted, but I wind up doing what my dad did.
Mm-hmm.
I have more guilt about it than he did because I'm also mom's surrogate husband. So you'd have to parse that out. So that could be different if the daughter was the surrogate friend or her partner to mother, and that she joined. Maybe she joined mom in hating father.
Mm.
And so then she shuts down avenues to date. So she winds up carrying the anger and the hate towards men that really belongs to that marriage that she was exposed to that she shouldn't have been. So you'd have to sort of parse that out. So yes, you could see differences, but you'd have to get the whole system sort of layered, investigated to figure out which way is which. But it's true that we get kids identifying with the addict, and we get kids who identify with the addict and the victim in the family, and they become both victim and victimizers as adults. They can take on both roles, both men and women.
When you were talking about it not really being covered by, the ACA umbrella, it's like, it probably wouldn't be good for the adult children of sex addicts, and then also for the ones that didn't experience it, for it to, like, you know, be discussed. And like, I just think, and I have an online community, and there's like a separate group for those who endured childhood sexual abuse, it wouldn't be necessarily appropriate for them to be sharing group at large. And same thing goes for them. Are there resources and support groups specifically for adult children of sex addicts?
Well, the short answer is yes. The longer answer is not many. There might be two. You know, I mean, in the back of the book, and I apologize, I don't have that up for you here.
I have it. I'll look in the back.
Yeah, that there's a link to a group, but there's not many. Because, you know, I think the shame is extra for this group.
Yeah.
I don't want to talk about it. I'd rather talk about my father's alcoholism, which is not insignificant.
But it's more societally acceptable.
Yeah. But there's a shamefulness in that adult child in a sex addict sort of wears the shame as it's his or hers. And so for me to go talk about it, it feels very exposed. So I hope that we'll see a growing number of meetings because of the book. That was one of the reasons we wrote the book, was to bring awareness to this, hopefully spur some movement, you know, in the adult children of alcoholic group. You know, Claudia Black reviewed our book, and she gave us a tremendous endorsement. We had some exchanges. She's such a
name.
She's a pioneer in the, in my opinion. So, you know, she said this is long overdue. And I don't disagree. So, you know, it's the adult children of alcoholics, the work that you're bringing awareness to, that group needs to help with this. So somehow it needs to get talked about without it being, I don't know that you need, I don't know the answer to your question around,
yeah,
separate that group out. You know, I guess my question to you, maybe you're a little more up on this, but why couldn't the adult child of a sex addict whose father or mother was also an alcoholic talk about both in the meeting? What would be the prohibition against that? What's the unwritten rule? Why not?
Here's how I feel about it. I feel like when it comes to sex addiction, the world at large seems to be, it seems to be about 20 or 30 years behind, in the sense that, like, I think that people still view it as more of a moral failing. You know, yeah. Like if you think about that, like you think about a marriage being ended, like somebody, like because one's an alcoholic versus if that spouse was a sex addict, like people are going to have a lot more compassion for, oh, but they're suffering from a disease. And so I think that there is this lack of information and an inability for people to really understand that, like, this is an illness or a sick, a trauma response. Like, I think that too many people view it as a behavior choice.
Yeah,
and
exactly.
So my concern would just be from the perspective of, like, wanting it to be a safe place for those who have experienced that, you know, and not having somebody say something that would be extremely inappropriate that might hurt that person's feelings, just because of the lack of education. It's mostly just like a safety standpoint, not wanting someone to, like, get triggered or to, like, you know, go into a trauma response because somebody said something very insensitive because they're not educated on the topic. That's like, that would just be my opinion on it. Not that it's not okay for them to share it, just more so for their safety and security. I would hate for somebody to say something to them and they're like, fuck it, I'm never going to these meetings again.
Yeah. You know, I think you're spot on. I think that's a good answer, and I think it's the right answer. Yeah.
You know?
But I guess I'm really delighted that you're kind of cracking the egg, because I've been wanting the adult children of alcoholic groups, individuals who are out there preaching for the gospel, so to speak, to get this word out, because it's, I'm betting 20 to 25%, maybe a third of those adult children. I don't have exact numbers for you, but I don't gamble. I would never, I don't know. Gambling is another one of those addictions that appeal to me. I don't got to give my money away. I bet you, you got a quarter to a third of those adult children of alcoholics who have sex addicted parents.
Well, this is going to be very interesting to see what kind of feedback and stir that this comes up. And, you know, I think one way that I can help is to, like, to have more episodes talking about this issue. Cause I'll just be honest. I mean, it's not something that I know, like, a whole hell of a lot personally. You hear a lot about emotional incest these days a lot more. So maybe by opening, you know, maybe cracking that door some more, that'll create the space for people to talk about this.
No,
but
I
I'm sure it also, go ahead.
Well, I was going to walk through the roles.
Yes, please. Yes.
So let's do that, because that, you know, we have the roles, which are really, you know, we have the hero, responsible child for the alcohol family system. We have the scapegoat. So you've talked about that. The scapegoat's the kid who draws attention away from the inappropriateness of the parents, right? And they become the identified patient. You talked about that. We have the lost child, and we have the mascot.
Mascot, yep.
You know, so these all sort of function within the system to help sort of manage the system as a whole. Well, the roles for adult children of sex addicts are similar but uniquely different. So, for example, the first role is the moral hero. It's the cop. It's the preacher. It's the pastor. It's the rabbi. It's the one who rails against sexual impropriety. So the hero in the adult child of sex and the sexually addicted family system says, I'm going to hide my parents' shamefulness by being rigidly upright morally. And then I will impose that on everybody else. So these people don't play very well. They don't play sexually very well. They have a hard time because they're busy carrying shame that's not theirs. So that's different than the responsible child to the alcoholic. So call it the moral hero. The second one is the emotional caretaker. So similar, but very specific to, caretaking
the spouse.
Spouse.
Okay.
The wounded parent. So that child now is identified as the one who has to take care of that parent. So they're propping up the system, right? This one is railing against sexuality. This one is propping up mom. And so now the third one is a version of the second one. This one's the emotional spouse, the one I write about in He's Married Tomorrow, Silently Seduced. Mm-hmm. This is the surrogate husband or wife. This one is more specific, where they turned into the lover, the sexualized boyfriend or girlfriend to the mother or father. So where there's kinkiness and there's sexual talk. So this role moves beyond caretaking. And the fourth role is the addict, the seducer, the seductress, the one who identifies with dad, who says, oh no, I'm not going to be the victim here. I'm going to be the one in charge. I'll do what the old man did or what mom did behind in the neighborhood. I will go out and now act out. So those are the four primary roles that we had listed in the book. We had a fifth one that we thought would kind of move over the whole system called the truth teller, the one who's always in your face about the truth, either as a kid or as an adult, you know, the one coming into the Thanksgiving dinner and confronting dad and mom, right? Listen, you know, so I think that's not as clearly identified, but those first four we see unique to the sexually addicted system. Now you can get back, you can get into those roles in other ways, but if you look at a sexually addicted system, you always see those roles. So those are different, related but different than the alcoholic system.
I think that what it really boils down to is like, it's like there's the laundry list, right? Like somebody reads that list and they're like, holy shit, that's me.
Yeah.
And it has nothing to do, it doesn't talk anything about like what happened. It's all about characteristics in the present. And that's what I always say to people. Instead of trying to figure out if your childhood was dysfunctional, first see if you can relate to these characteristics, you know? And so I think that that's probably how this works as well, is like, you know, having very clear characteristics that people can relate to, which will then make them perhaps more willing to consider the rest.
Absolutely. Yeah. And we have in the book, A Light in the Dark, the whole chapter on characteristics. I think we listed 12, if I remember right.
What are some unique, how are you approaching healing? Like what modalities have you found to be most effective in treating the trauma related to this?
Yeah, that's a good question. So the first thing, you know this from your adult child, you have to get the narrative right. You can't walk into an AA meeting and think you're going to heal from your impact of your father's sex addiction. Is that not going to happen? You need to have the proper portal to view from, right? So getting the story, knowing your story, writing your story, telling your story, and telling your story over and over again so that the shame begins to lift. Right? So the more storytelling that's specific, and this is where your observation that you need a safe space, I think is spot on, comes in on, I think is helpful. One of the things, we have some workshops that we do, educational workshops we do by Zoom, run by a colleague of mine, Lalani Sinclair. She and I are working on a workbook for adult children, specifically around disclosure and impact. And what we found, just to get off course here a bit, is that the adult children don't want to know all the dirty details. They want to know enough to make sense of their childhood, but not too much. What they really want to do is write an impact statement, and they want an amends from both parents. So that came up over and over again in our qualitative and our quantitative research, that these kids, they want to be heard and they want to be unburdened. They want their parents to say, this is not your responsibility. Can you imagine how much healing would happen if a parent could say something as specific?
Yeah, but we all want.
That's right. That's right.
Wouldn't that be so nice?
I sat in on a disclosure and an amends letter from a young woman to her father, and his amends to her was, don't ever get involved with somebody who I used to be. I thought we were all in tears. He unburdened her. So That's critical in the recovery process. Now, you might not get that. In the meantime, tell your story.
You most likely won't.
You most likely won't.
Yeah.
Although our next book is going to be, the book that my Bonnie and I are going to put together is specific to a call to the parents. Look, you have responsibility here. It's not enough to say, I screwed up. Here's my amends. I'm out of here. It don't work. Or I was the partner and the spouse. I'm a victim. I'm sorry. You know, too bad that I used you, but I'm the one who's wounded here. Right. We need adult children of sex addicts specific. So that's sort of the tail end. In the meantime, what we found in our workshop is that the thing that the adult children said they liked a lot was writing a timeline. Sort of doing a descriptive timeline of the whole sexual story. Oh, I see. This isn't about me. So a timeline, so journaling a timeline, we have an exercise we do that helps them sort of unburden or identify the shamefulness that they picked up and to sort of do what you can in terms of experiential. T.N. Dayton does a lot of experiential work. Experiential body work that unburdens that shamefulness.
Like psychodynamics or
what
is it called?
Psychodrama.
Psychodrama, yeah, that's what I meant.
Yeah, for sure. That stuff's very helpful. You know, any kind of sensory motor work, EMDR, stuff that like that, anything that allows wait a minute, this isn't mine. Oh, yes, it's in me, it's part of me, but it doesn't belong to me. And then to rewrite the moral code, where the heck am I going? What do I value? So having to reconstruct or put a stake in the ground about, this is what I see sexually for myself and romantically. There's nothing wrong with X. There's nothing wrong with this. And forget you, mom and dad. That's on you. I went out of your marriage. I'm going to go off and do my thing. And I'm in charge of the story. You're not. So rewriting, literally writing out the new moral code is also very important. So we think that in time, if we can get some of these parents to come around who have some recovery to help unburden their kids, we're going to give them we have specific lists we're going to give them. We have letters that we're going to help them write.
Well, I always wonder, I mean, honestly, it's like, is it worth putting the effort there? You know what I mean? I'm being honest.
Well, so there are, yes. So remember, there's a lot of recovering addicts.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah.
You know, and who are feeling burdened by their shame.
What
they've done to their kids. They need
that's so
help.
True.
They need it. They need some guidance.
Mm-hmm.
I think the harder audience will be the partners and the spouses of the sex addict because they feel so.
They feel like they're the victim.
Right. And it feels like they can't win. But. Mm-hmm. You know, and I understand that it is unfair, but it's the reality. If we look at it through the lens of the adult child, I'm sorry you were a victim, but I was victimized by you too. So I need to talk about
it. And I didn't have a choice in this matter.
Yeah. Yeah. And so, you know, one of my favorite fiction writers, Michael Connelly, in the Bosch series, he's got a statement where Bosch, the detective, is always chasing after the low profile murder victims. And his line is, either everybody counts or nobody counts. And I think that's true here. Everybody counts in this system or nobody gets it. You know? And so, anyway, so we have some educational workshops.
I have one last question that I think is important. I brought up to you earlier about how it's so hard to find a therapist for ACA issues. It's got to be even more challenging to find as it relates to these issues. Let's say somebody is an adult child of a sex addict and they're looking for a therapist. What would be some good questions for that person to ask a potential practitioner to suss out whether or not they're going to be a good fit?
I would ask them if they're aware of what the burden is to adult children. Have they read the book that we wrote, A Light in the Dark? Are they willing to read the book? Are they willing to help them learn their story from that perspective and not overuse their own models? Can they help them with that? Sometimes therapists are wedded to their model and they will impose their favorite therapeutic model over top of you and fit you into their model. Mm-hmm. You don't want to work with a therapist like that. So you want to ask if they can be sensitive to your story to get to know it, even if they aren't that familiar. I do an annual workshop for therapists called Best Practices. So I've got a group of people who have gone through the Best Practices workshop. They can contact me. I can see if somebody who, it's not a certification, it's just do's and don'ts.
Yeah, I have a lot of therapists that listen to the podcast, so that'll be good.
Yeah.
You know, I've had on is Laura Dye.
Oh, no, Laura. Yeah, Laura's great. Yeah,
I had her on.
Yeah, she's great.
Well, I loved this. I would love to have you back on, and anybody, like any other, you know, professionals that you work with that you think would be good guests for me to have on to spread the word on this topic, I'm glad to have them on. So
great. Okay.
Really nice. Appreciate your time.
Let it all go.